you have to enjoy the practice of farming as much as you like the idea of farming.
Welcome to the 331st installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. I recently saw a cartoon that featured a tired-looking 20-something couple standing in a barn. The woman, holding up a pair of piglets while the man takes a photo with his smartphone, says, "I'm beginning to think I only really like the Instagram part of owning a farm." The idea of living on a farm and making a living on the land is pretty enticing, but the realities of dealing with long days in the field while grappling with extreme weather and fickle markets are impossible to avoid. And if a farming entrepreneur chooses to market direct to eaters, that brings with it its own set of challenges. As a University of Minnesota Extension direct marketing specialist, Ryan Pesch works with farmers who are looking for guidance on how to sell their products straight to eaters in a way that's profitable and sustainable from a quality of life point of view. Pesch, who is the direct marketing specialist with the Extension Services Ag Business Management Program team, often presents at workshops and farm meetings around the state. He knows well the subject matter. Ryan and his family operate Lida Farm, a commercial vegetable operation in Minnesota's Otter Tail County. As a farmer, Ryan has direct experience selling wholesale, as well as to farmers markets via the CSA model and at a roadside stand. I've seen Ryan speak at a couple of LSP meetings, and have always been struck by the combination of positivity and frankness he brings to discussions about making a living direct marketing farm products. He believes there's no substitute for getting real farm experience, no matter how many books one reads, YouTube videos they watch, workshops they enroll in, or, yes, Instagram posts they peruse. That's why the sustainable ag movement excites Ryan. He feels it provides a relatively low-risk option for getting the experience people need if they're to determine whether they enjoy the practice of farming as much as they enjoy the idea of it. LSP and its allies have had success in recent years getting the Minnesota legislature to provide support for initiatives that build local and regional food systems. As a result, there are now an impressive array of public financial resources available to help fund initiatives that, among other things, get locally produced food into school lunchrooms. And on a more localized basis, LSP has been working in western Minnesota to help bring together farmers, small business owners, and local government officials who are interested in building community-based food systems that keep wealth local while providing food producers a good, sustainable living. After Ryan spoke recently at an LSP community food meeting in Madison, Minnesota, I caught up with him and we chatted about some of the important questions people should ask themselves before jumping into farming, particularly if it involves direct marketing. Ryan started our conversation by talking about the state of the local food movement and how it compares to what was going on when he started his career 2 decades ago.
Yeah, you know, hey, well, after 20 years, right? And I should say that, you know, part of my time in Extension, for a lot of my time in Extension, I was actually in community development. Even though I was this direct farm marketer, I wasn't on the ag side or the ag business management side of Extension. I wasn't, because I knew this stuff as Ryan Pesch, Extension Educator. I always did this stuff. You know what I mean? I know it. It's easy for me to do. I enjoy it. But, you know, so over those 20 years dealing with these issues, it's interesting, Brian. I would say we had a I've gone through at least one boom, one bust, and maybe now a new boom, right? You know, where we were 20 years ago to now, if you think about it, I mean, when I started in Extension, you know, most rural markets or farmers markets really weren't much of farmers markets, and there weren't that many of them.
Right.
I think Minnesota Farmers Market Association is just a point of contact. I mean, we're at, I think, what's 368 farmers markets in the state of Minnesota. That is a huge difference from 20 years ago. And you could point to the St. Paul farmers market, like, that's a solid farmers market. Yeah, been there 100 years, whatever. But not every town had a farmers market. Not everybody was engaged in this, or it may be harder to find some folks. Yeah. So a lot's changed. I mean, you've seen it yourself. But it seemed like the big trend I saw post 2008 with the Great Recession, there was a huge movement of people. And I don't know if you look at the data, that's the case with just entrepreneurship in general. when you have very large business downturns, people are like, hey, I don't know. I'm used to be full-time, now I'm part-time. And I need to find some other way of making dough, really, right? I got to. And so there were a number of people that really, and there was, I think, a real growth period in that 2008 to say a 2012 time period where a lot of people became local food farmers, right? They're like, I'm going to sell a farmer's market. I'm going to do CSA and I'm these kinds of things. And so I saw, at least in my neck of the woods, I certainly saw that. But then actually, I don't know if it's like the economy improved or it's like, boy, I could make more money doing other things. It seemed like there's a little bit of a bust, certainly in my area. I'm not the last CSA standing, but at that time, there were six established CSA operations in just, say, my four-county area of Minnesota. I'm the last of those original six still here, which is, and that seemed to be part of that bust at that time. And no doubt, I think that there's greater resurgence now, I mean, of local foods. Although it's kind of funny, having done it for a while, I feel like I'm losing perspective because people have been telling me for 20 years, like, you're on the cutting edge, Ryan. This local food thing's really getting somewhere. I was told that 20 years ago. and I'm being now told it again. So it seems like there's maybe some new entrants, right? Kind of some new generations that are engaging in farming, which is great. So I would say the big difference now is I think there's sort of more formal attention given to the local food movement, if we like to call it that. I personally like kind of the good food movement. That's a phrase that I really like, good food movement. It's a little more encompassing, you know, because it includes not just, you know, local food movement. It says like we're like these, the farmers market guys over here, we're like way over this corner. Right. But really the good food movements, including think of how people are just thinking about food. You know, you can thank Martha Stewart to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. We can thank the Food Network to some degree. It's this wider movement about people just discovering better food. And that can just be more people growing better food in their backyard. All of that's good. And I think the local food movement is sort of part of that bigger good food movement, if you will. And so I think that's a big difference now. It's like we have maybe some new entrants. We have some more people that are engaging and looking to do that kind of stuff, selling at markets and getting into the business side of it. But it's couched in this bigger movement. And it's also, I think, gotten, say, more attention from, say, a USDA and a Minnesota Department of Ag than it used to, right? I always felt like we were just like this small little tiny corner that nobody even knew existed in ag. The corner of ag that was there is there 20 years ago, but it seemed kind of quiet or underground. And now it's sort of more like, you know, people like the ag secretary is like, local food's important. You know, wow, boy, we didn't hear that 20 years ago. And there are programs that are targeted towards producers like us or special crop operators and people that are doing this kind of stuff. So I think that's a big difference.
So one thing that I, talking to some farmers and talking to people who, for example, have gone through our Farm Beginnings program, that I think is a really good trend, and I would be interested in your perspective on it. We had so many people who got into farming because they really like farming. They really like raising food. And maybe looked at the marketing end and the financial end of it as secondary. I guess, what are you seeing? I feel like maybe more and more folks are aware that, hey, that's great, but if I really want to make some kind of a living off of this, even a part-time living, I need to be looking at the marketing and the financial end from the beginning and get those skills honed just as well, as good as my skills of how to raise brassicas or something like that.
I always talk about this in workshops and stuff. They're kind of two main points, and kind of like the person as the farmer. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, vast majority of farmers are product people, not marketing people. And that's just a fact. I mean, I've talked to enough people, right? If anybody's ever said, if you got a good enough product, it's going to sell itself, they're 100% a product person, right? Yeah. And that's too often the case that what we do is we say, boy, I'm just going to learn how to, I don't know, raise the finest marbled beef or the best grass-fed beef and the best high nutrition eggs. And I'm all about the most beautiful looking broccoli and absolutely, you know, and that's all the product side. And the challenge of being direct farm marketers, you both you need to have the skills of production as well as the skills, I'll just say business skills, if you will, yeah, which includes marketing, but also the finances. People, farm operators have to at least kind of recognize that and say, how can I at least anticipate it? Because my own take is that none of these skills, let's say these, may call them soft business skills, they really only develop as you enter the market. You can't like say, I'm going to go practice selling eggs in my basement with my two toddlers. I mean, you could, yeah, right? But it's harder. I mean, it's the experience, the skills come as you do it. And so that's, I think, one of the challenges with being a beginning farm operator is to some degree, you have to sort of engage. And as you engage, your skills grow. And as your skills grow, your market grows, right? So it's hard to say, boy, I'm here in year zero. Please, Ryan, tell me the market for cherry tomatoes, and I'm going to right size it. And next year, I'm going to be at exactly the right size for my area and the people living here. It's like, it didn't work that way. I can't say, well, I mean, we can do this. We can say, we know what people basically are consuming in tomatoes. We know these numbers, and you can estimate them. This is just market research kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean, A, that you have the business skills to do that. You haven't kind of hung out the shingle long enough that people know that you do that and want that product. And there's always this question about, yep, people are eating that many tomatoes in a given area, yet we live in a niche world where everybody segments out. And, you know, maybe only 4% of those people are really about certified organic tomatoes, and only 32% of the rest are really into whether it's local or not. And that leaves probably 60% of people, I always say, that like really don't care about your quality of tomato at all. Like I want to reach those people. I think we all want to reach those people and knock them on the side of the head and say, hey, this is a better tomato and it's worth, you know, 50 cents a pound more. But that just is what it is. And so I think there's a lot to be said about how you, a business starts and it kind of grows into a market, mm-hmm, and it grows into the skills. The second part that I think is important is I always, with beginning operators, I always like to emphasize, I don't know if it sounds kind of chippy, but I'm always like, you have to enjoy the practice of farming as much as you like the idea of farming. Mm. And I think there's a lot to be said there. I've run into many, many people that are at that year zero or their year negative three, right? They haven't even launched yet. They're sort of like, I'm over here. I have this interest. And that's super laudable. And I love that, right? Yeah. Because there's that energy. It's like, I want to do this. It's great. But you got to test that assumption. The farmers that get into a business long enough that they begin to see that they're beyond break even and they're financially viable, like even at a part-time level, mm-hmm, are those that enjoy the practice of farming. Because if you don't enjoy that practice of farming, it's kind of this weird pipe dreamy thing that you can sit and admire. I kind of admiring the problem. You know, talk about people talking community development about admiring the problem, right? Right. A lot of communities admire a problem, or different groups of people admire a certain problem. And this is sort of like admiring an aspiration, right? Before you know it, you're four books in on your next, you know, farm dreaming escape, and you're like, okay, this is great. I'm inspired. All right, I got the inspiration I need. Now we need to put it into practice. Mm-hmm. And you find where it fits in your life, right? And that's right. And as years progress, you sort of feel like, okay, this is still fitting in my life. This still feels good. And part of it feeling good is, for me, I enjoy that sweaty 10-hour day, because at the end of the day, I'm kind of body tired. And that's sort of part of the almost the runner's high of farming, the farming, yeah, high, you know what I'm saying? And yeah, that was part of the enjoyment of sort of that daily process of farming. I enjoy the, you know, like, let's get physical with some shovels for 4 hours. And the whole time you're there, you're like, this is just prison labor. And there's no redeeming value for what I'm doing. I'm now trapped in some menial nightmare. Yep, you're not in love with the practice of farming. You might have liked the idea of farming, mm-hmm, but we've got to kind of separate that out. And you really only know once you sort of engage.
Right.
And so I'm always a big fan. I never want to say, your idea is wrong, shake your finger at them. My point is always, your number one thing ought to be to start. Start is the term. And only once you really engage, and you engage safely, right? You engage without too large of a risk, right? Oh, I'm going to go, you know, get a second mortgage on my house for another $250,000 and just sort of go hog wild. Don't advise it. I really don't. But you engage in some form that seems appropriate for your stage of life, and you go from there. Yeah. And that's how you really find out, like, yes, I love this practice of farming. And yes, I can see how I can stepwise get to where I need to go in terms of like farm finances or building a customer base.
That kind of leads into my next question. I think there's a lot of overlap. Is I was going to ask you, what are some of the big questions folks should be asking themselves before they start on their farming dream, or start even kind of dip their toes into it? But it sounds like a really big question is, do I enjoy farming? That's a big one. But is there
that
any
is a other, big one.
Other big questions that you see people sometimes not asking, or they're a little bit surprised when you ask that question?
Well, you know, I think, you know, again, at that year zero, it's hard. It's always hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this question about the size of market and willingness to pay for products, I think are a bit of a mystery for people, and kind of like how to wrap their mind around that. I appreciate the enthusiasm where people are like, just like, I got the world's best beefsteak tomato. And when this is brought into the world, all is right. You know, the question is then, all right, how many of these tomatoes do you have to sell in order to make this start to work? Or how many customers do you think you can really get in year one? Or, you know, what's a reasonable amount of sales that you could have at that one small rural farmer's market? Mm-hmm. Or, boy, how do you think you're going to compete in that bigger urban market? Well, there's already 40 other people there that have been doing it for a while, right? So these are kind of challenging questions that, I mean, they're not there to be kind of a total roadblock. But again, it's that going from year zero to year one, those are just kind of like basic questions that there's not a clear answer to, but right. You at least have to sit down and say, okay, what's reasonable for me to do here in year one? And that's what I'm always talking year zero, year one, year two, year three. Those first 3 years are super important, right? You know, that's sort of where a lot of learning happens on the job. And you learn so much about the customers you're trying to cultivate, right? And so those I think are sort of the challenging questions. The other ones, you know, get a little more financial. You can just get down to questions like, well, how much are you willing to lose at this? Right? You're going into year one. Maybe you have a day job, or your wife has a day job. Maybe you have two kids. Maybe you're just retired, whatever. But you're like, okay, how much am I willing to put into this? You know, I got a 3-year plan. If after 3 years, I lost 25 grand, but I love the experience, you could chalk that up as a success, right? But you want to be somewhat clear-eyed about, like, okay, what's this going to take? Estimate that out. Estimate out kind of what you think you could reasonably bring in, and then just go from there. If it feels like too big of a risk, you're like, yeah, I'm not in the place to throw 15 grand at this right now. Right. Well, how can we get started with 3 grand or 2 grand? And, you know, I mean, my own point of comparison, like after 2 years as an apprentice, I farmed on 1 acre of land in Lake Elmo, Minnesota, that I rented, and we sold at one farmer's market. That first year I bought a Ford Ranger truck that ended up having a bad block and started smoking after a while, but that was $1,000. I bought an Earthway seeder. I purchased my plants, and I bought a hoe or something. No, I bought a wheel hoe, my Glazer wheel hoe. So I had like, I mean, my outlay that year was about, I don't know, $1,800. And the total sales that year was, is like $3,200 or $3,400. I sold 12 times the one farmer's market on a Saturday morning. And that's, I was like, I don't know, that's my start. That's what it looked like to me. We can adjust for inflation now. Maybe it looks more like, you know, 3,000 in and 4,000 in sales or 4,500 in sales. But, you know, oftentimes starting looks that way. And that's a very, very, the saving grace of the sustainable ag movement has forever been that it's about low input farming, low input startup. how do you get started in sort of this bootstrappy way? It's never been part of the culture of the sustainable ag community to just say, well, you know, USDA is handing out money. Just go get some of that and go for it. You yeah. can do that. There's no doubt about that. And USDA will now recognize us maybe more as legitimate farmers than they once did. Mm-hmm. But still, that's how a lot of the people I know of my generation, I'm 47, kind of started in sustainable agriculture. They started in this low input, lower risk farming startup stage and kind of grew from there. And so hopefully I'm not too hamstrung by that point of view, but I think there's some wisdom in that point of view as well. That's kind of what built, you know, the organic and sustainable food movement, at least in the upper Midwest that I know of.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point in that if you're getting involved in quote unquote conventional ag, you're maybe taking over your family's corn soybean operation, you know, farming a couple thousand acres right off the bat, boy, your risk is way high, much higher than if, and let's say you are getting supported through the traditional government programs and all that, great, but still you may have great support, but you have great risk. Whereas with the sustainable ag movement, regenerative ag movement, whatever you want to call it, it's because it's kind of been ignored by these programs. That is kind of a incentive right there not to lay out your risk right from the beginning. You kind of do have to enter it unless you're coming from a wealthy background or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, and that's one of those hard things. Like I always talk with beginning people, like let's set a budget of basic equipment and annual rent or something. Like what are we starting? If we're starting on a half an acre, if we're starting on that one empty lot in South Minneapolis or something, right? Yeah. I mean, we can identify some of these costs based on understanding of what might be your production system in year one, right? Like we start with a modest production system. We're not buying all these fancy, we're not buying, I don't know, those fancy carrot harvester buncher things that they make in Germany for, I don't know, $300,000. You're not doing that in year one. I hope you aren't. You know, you can get that number. And then once you have that number and you have that estimate of that number, then you can back out from that number and you just say, all right, what do we have to earn here in year one, year two, year three, in order to make that work, you know, to pay off your Grillo walking tractor in 3 years? That's not a bad deal, actually. Yeah. I mean, you're in a kind of a good place in year four and five and six, aren't you? But likewise, if you take on some form of debt, it's sort of like if you have a debt and you know what that debt is, well, you can calculate where you really need to be in order to just make this thing go. If you don't have, the bigger that number is, the more you're under pressure to make, let's say, this minimal amount in year one, that is, it could actually just be too much stress for year one, right? You're better at that lower debt level. And I mean, if you have to bring in like, hey, we need $3,000 a week or this doesn't work, that's not a good place to be in at the beginning. Because one thing I try to get across to people, and I really think it's true, farming, and especially in direct marketing, because it's more like, we're more like retailers than we are traditional farmers, right? We're selling things, we're finding customers, we're marketing, we're promoting, all this stuff. Every business takes time to get established. Right? We talk about just building market share, just finding a customer base. Mm-hmm. And that just simply takes time. And it's like with a lot of like financing that you need to start a business, you're essentially just buying yourself time. And that's the case if you're running a shoe store or you're opening a grocery store or you're, I don't know, running a restaurant. You might not find enough customers until year two, until year three, until year four. Financing or a pot of money of some form only gives you that time. You might be losing money, and plenty of businesses do lose money. Main Street businesses lose money year one, year two, but you know what? Oh, we made it happen in year three. That's normal. That's normal. And so sometimes I find that beginning operators get a little frustrated. Like, I don't know. I did this thing year one. I lost $800 or I lost $1,200. And they're frustrated by that. Well, get in line. I mean, that's just business development is what
right.
it is.
Right.
And it's just, you just broaden your sight line a little bit to say, all right, we might have to be looking 3 years in order to get to a place where it's like, this is working or it's not. Mm-hmm. And that's, on our own place, we've always said, we have to give something 2 years. We don't give it two seasons. whether it's a new product or a new thing that we're doing, if it's not working after two seasons, we might cut it. But you got to give it two seasons. Otherwise, you really don't know. You've never given customers a chance to buy the product or to get to know you. You haven't. You don't learn instantly, even though we're on social media all the time. Yeah. People think it's more instant than it is. It actually takes a little while.
So, Ryan, I saw you the other night at an LSP meeting we had in Madison, Minnesota, where we were talking about food hubs. And you have, I think, worked with some food hubs. And I guess maybe if you could just give a really brief for listeners who might not be familiar what a food hub is. But then also I wanted to talk to you about what potential you see for these for food hubs right now. There's a lot of excitement. To tell you the truth, I hear about more food hubs who go out of business than the ones that stay and are viable for several years down the road. But we are starting to see a few that seem to be maybe making a go of it. I mean, what's your perspective on those? Could you just give us a brief couple sentences? What is a food hub?
Yeah, food hub is an organization. It could be first party or third party that brings together food from multiple farms and then sells to an end consumer, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of times this is related to, say, farm to institution stuff or better meeting the needs of that larger hospital down the street. Like, they don't want to deal with the six individual small operators. The small operators get their food and they sell it to the food hub or bought by the food hub, and then it's sold. It comes in different formats. You know, there's these farmers market food hubs. I've worked with some. And they're organized around farmers markets to try to make them a little more streamlined. And then what a lot of people think of is like Sprout or the Good Acre, kind of two more prominent food hubs in the state that have been around a long time at this point. And they're the third party, right? They're not owned by the farmers. They're not managed by the farmers. It's a third party that's buying the food from the farmers that they're in turn sells it. As far as the state of them, I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, I look back at, you know, man, too much of an applied economist type, but you know, Cooperative Development Services did a very good report, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago, when there were more food hubs in the state, saying, you know, look, at food hubs are, by their definition, they're acting as wholesalers. They're like a new wholesale startup. For many people who have criticisms of the current food system and how it operates and who benefits and all that stuff, one thing's for sure is that the wholesale food business is not, it's not a business with a lot of margin in it. You know, like I said, hey, at best, you're talking 20% margin in wholesale overall.
Yeah.
So I want to say they put up a number. It's like, unless you're at about 2 million in sales doing this, it's hard, right? The economics are hard.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the difficulty of food hubs. Again, I think there's some energy about how do we do some of the same functions of a food hub? Because there are these interests of other buyers and there's instant of larger buyers. Like, how do we meet their needs without just going to, say, this model of a third party food hub? And that's I think people are working at that. Yeah. I mean, another model, you know, isn't really a food hub as much as just farmers cooperating. Like, you can have one farmer that has a oversized walk-in cooler and they're just holding product from two other farmers and they sell it together. I mean, it's almost like a grower packer situation or something. I mean, it doesn't have to be complicated. I think that at times we sort of make it seem like it should be bigger than it is. Let's go buy a building and compete against Sysco. And you know, a bunch of ragtag farmers going against Sysco. It's just kind of I don't know if that's a good idea personally. Yeah. It might be inspiring. People might be inspired by that, but I don't know if that's a great idea. Well, the economics are tough, I guess, is what it comes down to.
And what kind of helps a little bit is, boy, whether it's a food hub or you're doing farm to school or other things, at least here in Minnesota, there's a lot of resources now available through the MDA, some stuff that's been passed at the legislature. I get a sense that there's maybe more money than ever available for farmers to set up an infrastructure. Yes.
Absolutely. And the farm to school procurement grant is absolutely massive. I mean, with a $3 million infusion for this current school year, it was infused, you know, more than a year ago from Build Back Better bill. That's a lot of money. Previously, a lot of the funding from MDA really went towards equipment, which I always thought was a little bit indirect way of making farm to school happen, an important component, no doubt. But the procurement grant is like, here you go, school, here's $10,000. You spend that on food. That is a more, seems to have more direct impact. And I know as a person that's involved in some of the evaluation of that program, it certainly is engaging a wider net of producers and a wider mix of goods, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas it used to just traditionally be a couple of local veggie operators in the school or supplying the school. Now it's a wider mix of products from maple syrup to a lot of meat products and so forth. So I think the time's going to tell, right? The resources we have, I think, are able to jumpstart that market. And I think what's really important is that hopefully there are relationships, these buying-selling relationships that get created through this startup funding that live, right? That live longer than the grant funds alone. And I think that's really where the rubber is going to meet the road, and we're going to see how well that's played out over the last couple of years.
For more information on community food systems, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground, episode 331 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.